The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Yo ho ho, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm Mark Hadley, his relationship counsellor. Welcome to episode 53 of The Big Picture for the week beginning April 3rd. And coming up on today's show, the 7-year switch on TV suggests relationships can be rescued by living with someone else. Yes, really.
I spent 90 minutes in heaven and I want you to share my experience. Mm-hmm, that's what I want you to do.
And the high cost of climbing mountains and the top 5 sequels we actually want someone to make.
The top 5 sequels we actually wanted to make. I'm looking forward to that.
I'm
top
very
five
excited.
List at the end.
I'm very
and
excited.
We're going to do it. We don't normally do this, but we're going to share duties on the top 5 list.
We can surprise each other.
We'll hear a few from you. You'll hear a few from me. It'll be the best top 5 list this show. Before we get there, though, and before we get to all the other reviews we're going to be covering off to this week. Also happening this week around the place is a little movie you might like to call, Mark, The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book,
out on April 7. I've lived my whole life without reading The Jungle Book. I haven't seen the Disney cartoon. So all that's about to change. But you're going to review the new version of The Jungle Book, which is starting this week. You're going to review that on the next show. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think of that. And I think I'm actually going to check it out myself.
You should. And also tonight on the ABC, something you shouldn't actually check out because it's on right now. So if you are, what are you doing?
Tune out on that.
Turn the sound down. Matilda and Me. When the Royal Shakespeare Company of the UK took on a risky sort of mouthy comedian like Tim Minchin to compose a musical based on Roald Dahl's Matilda, little did they know what they'd be preparing for. So this is a documentary series showing how hard it is to basically put a musical together and the particular flair of an Aussie comic and how he can bring something to a classic English tale. I'm afraid it's on right now, like I said, but, you know, that's why God created iView.
On Blu-ray and DVD and all that kind of stuff this week is Creed, one of the biggest surprise hits of last year.
Very good film.
Sylvester Stallone's Rocky franchise returned, but it's punching in new directions. You can check out our review right now by going to thebigpicturewebsite.com. So don't go and watch that Matilda show, but you can go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and check out this review while you're still listening to us on the other device.
Yes, because that's kind of multi-screening.
That's okay.
This is the last time I mention it. I promise this is the absolute last time I mention this until it actually gets released on Blu-ray. But the final episode of the final season of Downton Abbey is on the 7 Network this Monday night at 9 p.m. And when, according to the marketing, the respectable Crawleys go Game of Thrones. I don't even know what that means.
What?
But it should be something worth watching. You have been warned. Go to it.
Wow, the best part about all those sentences was Downton Abbey is finishing. In my books, it says the guy who's not much of a fan. But I know there are plenty out there. Good on you. See how Game of Thrones gets.
How is your marriage going?
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking. I am married to a Downton Abbey fan. That's true. In entertainment news this week, Matt, have you heard about this? Move over Judge Judy. A production company in the States has said that former Governor Sarah Palin, you know, Sarah Palin, that was big in American political stakes a couple of years ago in the presidential race. She signed a deal to make a pilot for a reality courtroom TV show. And apparently that pilot is going to be filmed very soon. And they're hoping it will get to air in 2017.
Wow.
So maybe if Donald Trump doesn't go so well in the presidential race, but he's already had his TV show. Maybe The Apprentice will come back. Maybe The Apprentice and Sarah Palin. I don't know.
That would be Sarah Palin on The Apprentice. Australia's Melissa George has landed the leading role in Heartbeat, an American medical drama television series based on the real life of Dr. Kathy Magliato, as described in her book Heart Matters. Now, George plays Alex Pantieri, a world-renowned heart transplant surgeon who struggles to balance her personal and professional life. This is a major gain, you know, for George. She's doing really well.
But not to be confused with that Heartbeat TV series for ages.
This is a new American one. Basically, the new Grey's Anatomy, you know, of the US. So this is going to be great. Congrats from The Big Picture.
All right. That's what's happening this week.
Well, as we promised, later in the show, we're going to be talking about sequels we want someone to make. So that led our producer to a little-known fact about an 80s classic. Heard of that little ditty, The Breakfast Club?
I may have heard of that movie, Mark.
Incredibly popular film.
Did you
know that the director, John Hughes, originally planned to do a series of sequels of that classic high school Finding Your Place film?
Like a franchise, yes, of The Breakfast Club.
Yes, very much so. Is this kind of like The Lord of the Rings.
Is this your true or false question for us this week?
True or... Well, it's not true or false. It's multiple choice.
Okay.
He did, in fact, plan to do a series of sequels. He intended he'd do one every A, year for 5 years, B, every 10 years, sort of 7-Up style, or C, every time one of the major characters died.
I actually want to go with C because it sounds like the nutsiest option on that
list. Hold on. After we do what your kids are watching this week, we'll come back and we'll check out, you know, which of those is correct.
Okay.
Well, actually, speaking of what your kids are watching this week, we're having a look at the 7-year switch. Last month, I got Ben to review Channel 7's reality show, First Dates. Let's face it, because I wanted a laugh. But... to his total surprise and my shock, he liked a lot of what he'd said about relationships.
I really did.
I know. So when I heard that the 7 Network was introducing the 7-year switch, I thought, who better to check out 7's new stranger-than-reality show about relationships? My old pal and glutton for punishment, Ben, took a look at this show about shock couples therapy. What on earth did he come away with?
Tim's not affectionate.
No holding hands.
He doesn't like public affection. He's not very romantic.
What about a little hug around the waist?
No thanks.
If things don't change, then this isn't going to last.
So you're essentially living with an experimental partner.
We're going to be living with someone else.
You've got to be joking.
She's reasonably good looking, I have to give her that.
We are both very similar people.
Mark, you've heard the premise of the show, I know, because you're the one who told me about the 7-year switch. But for anyone who hasn't tuned in or hasn't heard anything about this, which may not be you, whoever's listening to this, because 1.3 million people watched the first episode of the 7-year switch the other week. So a lot of people do know what it's about. But if you don't, four couples on the brink of separation, some are married, some aren't, but they've been in long-standing de facto relationships.
Well, 7 years or so is the idea.
Well, that's the idea. That's what the title says. But even in the first episode, they don't actually make it clear whether these couples have been in relationships for 7 years. It just sounds like someone came up with a catchy little title based on that concept of the 7-year itch. And went switch, and then they put it in a show, and then they don't even say in their first episode whether all the couples have been together for 7 years. But there being that as it may, four couples on the brink of separation are going to live with a total stranger for 2 weeks as they embark on, and as that 7-year switch says time and again throughout all of these episodes, they're embarking on a new social experiment where they put their relationships on the line in order to save them. And the thing that the 7-year switch does is the four couples, there's Ryan and Cassie, Michelle and Jason, Talina and Brad, Jackie and Tim. And then out of those four couples, effectively you take them apart as eight people and then you mix and match the couples. So
when you say they go to live as couples, what do you mean they go to live as couples?
It's like kind of difficult to explain, but let's just take Ryan and Cassie and Michelle and Jason. So Ryan's married to Cassie, Michelle and Jason together. Ryan and Michelle live together in a house for 2 weeks. Cassie and Jason live together in a house for 2 weeks. And then they go on sort of, they get little tasks to do and that kind of thing, like plenty of other reality shows. But basically what they're there to do, allegedly, is to sit around and talk about their relationships. And they've been paired together, these two different members of different couples, paired together because they're more similar to each other than what they are with their original couple. It's very confusing even to try and explain it out loud. But
No. You're starting to give me the impression that they're actually trying to tempt people away from their relationship.
Temptation does figure that the episode that was on this week was very big on how tempting an environment this can be for people in couples who, even though they're on the rocks, but they're saying they want to stay together. That's why they're doing this experiment. Even that, there's things in the show that put them in positions of being highly tempted to do something intimate with the other person in the house.
Just accidental, of course, because this is TV and things just happen accidentally. Look, is this more of a train wreck show than First Dates?
Yeah, it is. It is. What I liked about First Dates is I didn't feel like it had put people together on screen so that they would combust, so that you'd watch them explode on screen and have massive fights, or that kind of train wreck TV that we can get where we just want to watch people fail or crumble in
front of
our eyes.
Kind of what's happened to My Kitchen Rules. It's not about the cooking anymore. It's about the explosions.
Yeah. And First Dates, I thought, didn't try to do that. I think the 7-year switch seems to be angling towards that, particularly these tempting scenarios, including in the houses that the people share, there's only one bed. which can be solved very quickly by the man being man and just saying, come on, man, I'll just take the bed. I'll take the couch. You take the bed. But you know, those kind of issues ensue as these couples live together. But the train wreck thing actually turns into more of watching something that's really sad and painful, more than tuning in to watch people destroy themselves. It actually gets a little bit awkward and icky at points because it's so sad watching people at the bottom of their relationship, talking about their relationship, how they respond to their relationship, what's led to it. It's actually kind of not great TV, really.
Yeah, it's just sad. Well, it is. Should parents be concerned if their kids are checking out the 7-year switch?
Yeah, I think they should, in as much as I think teens are probably most likely to be checking this out. What you'd be concerned about if you're a parent and your kids were watching this is, are they tuning in because they think it's a helpful model or a realistic or supportive one for restoring relationships? Again, all the couples on this show claim that they're intending to restore their relationships. And coming up later in the show, we've got a psychologist. There's two psychologists involved in the 7-year switch. Joe Lamble is going to be speaking with Mark about the psychological profiling going on behind the scenes on this show. And again, this social experiment that's being put up on screen is suggesting it's a helpful model for relationships. I strongly question that, pretty much based on what we're seeing on the screen, let alone other things I believe and hold
dear.
Mate,
I'll go further. I think that sounds just crazy. Like, if your relationship is about to tank, and then you think the best possible thing you could do is go on national television and tell everybody about it and live with somebody else and see whether or not you would prefer them?
It's part of the reason that the show can be difficult to watch and let alone like not even really wanting to. As you just said, it goes everything from baffling to just, why are you even taking part in this? To you get the desperation in people, and that can be painful to watch, let alone off-putting, let alone constantly going back to, why are you even doing this?
Well, what's to be learned, I mean, from the 7-year switch? Is there anything you can take away from it? Would you say, okay, there's something they get right?
Not so much, apart from eventually these couples, when they're forced into these, not forced, when these other houses and they've got the time to talk about their issues, they talk with other people about their issues, but they haven't really talked with their partner or their spouse about them.
So the talking's good.
The thing to learn is the communication. Maybe do that before you go off into this tempting environment with another. Instead, talk to your significant other about what's going on. It reminded me a lot, though, of the portrait of relationships that goes along through the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. And there's such a communal focus to that. And I can give an example of God's institution of marriage. And when we get married, it's quite a public event. And the people, when we come together as a congregation, effectively around a married couple, will often say in public that we support this marriage and we will do all we can to support the people in that marriage. I think that's a great representation of how God set up relationships in a way of assisting others, not so intimately as your significant other, but at least in a way where you're concerned about what's going on with other people. If you see them struggling, help them out, as opposed to letting them get to the situation they're in where they go on a national TV show living in a house with another couple for 2 weeks and thinking that is the only way they can save themselves.
Or the reprehensibly irresponsible idea of putting them in that show and creating situations where you could potentially make it worse.
Yeah, I think it pointed to me that there's an onus of responsibility on those in the relationship, but also those outside of it too, to really get behind supporting that relationship to be all it can be.
Mate, thanks. Well, the 7-year switch airs every week. Look, I promise, by the way, not to do that to you again. It airs every week on Tuesday from 9 p.m. on Channel 7. After it airs, you can find it online at the Plus 7 site. It's rated M, some swearing, and a fair bit of sex talk. Ben's surprised it's not rated MA15+.
I was a little bit surprised at that. Yeah, there's some controversial stuff on there.
Yeah, well, there you go. Okay, look, that brings us now, I guess, to the answer of our true and false question. See, prior to talking about what your kids are watching this week, I posed the situation. The director of The Breakfast Club, John Hughes, originally planned to do a series of that classic high school Finding Your Place film, and he intended to do a sequel every year for 5 years, B, every 10 years, sort of 7-Up style, or C, every time one of the major characters died. Now, what do you think John Hughes was aiming for with his sequel?
C,
every time one of the major characters died. Well, close, but no cigar. It actually was every 10 years. He was actually going to bring the whole cast back together every 10 years and say, here we are again, right up until whenever. I don't know, until one of them died. Look, none of them happened, though. And the reason why is because apparently Judd Nelson and Molly Ringwald just didn't like John Hughes.
Oh, the stars of The Breakfast Club didn't like the director.
He was the sort of director who wouldn't go away, apparently. He said, want to do another movie? We could do another movie. How about that? No.
more amazing stuff like that revelation is coming up on The Big Picture, including, as we just mentioned, as we were talking about the seven-year switch, Mark speaks with Jo Lambert, one of the psychologists involved with the show, and what does she say about the thinking that goes on behind the love competitions that are on our small screens?
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Ben and Mark basically trying to work out what sort of things you should be watching this week, Ben.
But before we get to those things, Mark, before we get to Sherpa at Cinemas and 90 Minutes in Heaven on DVD and the sequels we really want to see made, that's coming at the top five list at the end of the show. Before that, we're at Soundtrack Choice for this week, a song that was originally performed by Miami Sound Machine, but has been done in the distinct tones of... Come on, shake your body, baby, do that conga.
That's not actually a CD malfunction, is it?
Mark, we did talk about how long could we actually play that version of Conga by Miami Sound Machine as performed in Alvin and the Chipmunks 4. We did talk about how long we played. The Road Chip. We think we got through about 45 seconds then before we thought we'd do all of you a favour and stop playing it. Now, the reason we chose
for
that
those people who actually
week,
have just had some form of seizure, we just like to apologise for playing that on the radio.
On behalf of ourselves. But there was a good reason why we played that. It's basically because the movie that we wanted to talk about, we could not find a song to play from it. So Alvin and the Chipmunks 4, The Road Chip, is out now on DVD and Blu-ray, but so is Snoopy and Charlie Brown, the Peanuts movie. And my goodness, Mark, it was difficult to find a song from that we could play.
Well, basically, it's because there's some classic jazz, and that's basically what is actually being played, which doesn't make for great Sunday
night radio. So it was like
classic
jazz or the high-pitched...
But go get the Peanuts movie, because
conga.
That's a fantastic one for the kids, particularly about the morals and, in fact, the way it actually celebrates people who are serving others. You know, that is a really good film. So the Chipmunks, the Road Chip, maybe save that for someone you really don't like.
Yeah, so what we've really done is... hopefully forced you out of the house right now to go out and get the Snoopy, the Peanuts movie, as the sounds of Alvin and the Chipmunks are ringing in your ears. Up to our first now showing choice this week, Mark. Mount Everest is the visual essence of peace and the site of stirring human endeavor, and also the location of a life-threatening brawl at the top of the world. For almost a century, the world's highest mountain has attracted Westerners bent on conquering the heights and themselves. But Sherpa is a new documentary that reveals how all the time our heroic climbers have been standing on the shoulders of the native people who guided them. And in an age of increasing commercialization, those who benefit are increasingly prepared to trade their guides' lives for their mountaintop experiences. So, Sherpa is a film that lays bare the cost of Western individualism and actually demonstrates a point on which Buddhist and Christian viewers can heartily agree.
We Sherpa people have a great respect for the mountain. She's the mother god of the earth.
Over here, we climb mountains, but it's a holy place. Western people approach it as a physical challenge. To see how close you can get to death.
We have about 120 Sherpas or so that have died so far.
The risks that people were making the Sherpas take, what is the moral justification for that?
Okay, you may not see yourself as a documentary watcher. This is the title that will change you. Sherpa is an eye-opener. Make no mistake, it is certainly one of the most visually stunning documentaries I have ever seen. It is very creative in the way that it's been put together. Renan Ozturk, the film's high-altitude cinematographer, uses an incredible combination of time-lapse photography and extreme close-ups to scale Everest's beauty and threat. But it's the human story that's really at the heart of this that is the thing that will hold you the longest. Sherpa introduces you to a fellow called Ferber Tashi. He's the Sherpa who has summited Everest an incredible 21 times. At the beginning of the film, if he goes up one more time, he will hold the world record for climbing it the most times. But Ferber's mother and family can't stand the idea that he's doing this. Firstly, they find it kind of disrespectful because they have a very sort of spiritual take on the mountain as the Sherpa people. But secondly, it's because he's literally risking his life every day, every time he does it. And why does he do it? It's for the money. There's a horrible commercialization of what's going on that's laid bare in Sherpa about the Westerners who are really making their lifetime achievements on the backs of these people, as Ben sort of said in the introduction. It's an incredible thing. And when an avalanche kills 18 Sherpas inside the film itself, all hell breaks loose. And we start to get to see the ugliest side of what we lovingly call individualism.
Mark, here on The Big Picture, we like to bring a Christian perspective to popular culture. The reason we feel we're able to do that is, A, we're Christians, and B, my background's in film reviewing, but yours is in script writing and documentary making. It sounds like you really like this documentary, which I imagine is pretty, like, it's high praise coming from a documentarian yourself, but why is it so good? And you mentioned it right at the start, you think if people don't like documentaries, if they're already tuning out of this segment right now, they should tune back in. Because why should they check out this documentary?
Here's my recommendation. 3 decades of making documentaries professionally for a living. This film, I will put in my top 5 easily.
Oh,
it is incredible.
With a bullet.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know. So go see this. It is the perfect combination of imagery and supporting the real idea. The real threat on the mountain is not the ice. It's the Westerners. You know, that's the really crazy thing. And when you see pictures and style come together, you get a real sense of it. You know, climbers come from all walks of life. I'm actually a climber. I'm a professional rock climber. Actually, professional is wrong. Insofar as I was paid to teach people how to rock climb. Did that for about 15 years. And so I've got a healthy respect for that as a sport. I love it personally. Some people are spending upwards of $100,000 Australian to have this experience of a lifetime. But whose life is being spent, you know, in the process?
Is Sherpa telling the same story as the big budget action adventure Everest was last year on screen?
No, it was the story that Everest tried to tell, but in the end, Everest was very forgiving of the Westerners who were involved and said very little about the Sherpas who were spending their lives trying to get people up to the top of the mountain.
It's the same events, though, or no?
No. Different series of events. In fact, this actually is set in reality, obviously, as a documentary after the story of Everest. So in Everest, a bunch of Western climbers actually they have their lives threatened and several die. In this, 18 Sherpas actually die, and it barely rates a headline in the Western news.
Now, is it as simple as the Westerners are the bad guys here pushing the little guy around? Is that the message of Sherpa?
No, it's much more complex than that, because actually some of the nicest people in the film are the tour organizers, people who actually have a heart for the Sherpa people and are trying to do the right thing, but are caught between a rock and a hard place. The Sherpas really do need the money. Okay, there is, apart from cattle, you know, there's very little in the way of industry in this area. So they can actually make in a couple of weeks a year's wages. Okay, and for impoverished families, that's a huge temptation. And so you've got the operators who are trying to hire people, but at the same time, they're feeling the pressure from the clients they're taking on from all over the world who've decided they're going to climb Everest, and they've paid a huge amount of money to do so, so they better get to the top of that mountain. And consequently, you get a bunch of people coming in who have no place in climbing. Honestly, they would not be on any peak, you know, below the snow line, let alone above, you know, and yet they're there because they've got the money, and so therefore they've got the right. And that's basically a Western mentality.
So there are also big spiritual implications coming out of this film. You were telling me before that somehow there's things flowing out of this film that Buddhists and Christians can agree on.
Yeah, basically, Western individualism is very, very self-centered. I mean, if I can do it, I should be allowed to do it. Or in this case, if I can pay for it, I should be allowed to do it. The Sherpas are much more respectful in their structure. So they have a spiritual approach to the mountain, which I don't think Christians would necessarily own, but they have a sense of family impact for what they're doing. Will they do something for their own sake, or will they do it for the family unit they belong to? And so Christians, I think, get right alongside that. I mean, Jesus says, when he's talking about who are the greatest people in the kingdom of God, he's going to say those who serve others, those who give up for the sake of others. The whole definition of Christian love is sacrificial love, putting somebody above yourself, doing what is best for them. And you see this, sadly, you see this, you know, in one respect, more in the eyes of the Sherpas who don't follow Jesus than the Westerners who've been raised in Christian cultures.
You see it more
cultures.
In their actions, yeah, you mean, in the and way the behavior, their thinking.
In the way that they behave, they are a better illustration of what Jesus was getting at.
The Sherpas are.
Than the Westerners who should have actually known better.
Wow, what did that prompt you as a Christian to think? Like, did you go out and change your ways instantly, Mark?
Well, I'll be honest. It really made me reevaluate. Although I have a lifetime goal of I'd like to climb, you know, an oxygen peak. I'd like to climb a peak, you know, of that height. And I've thought about that for years. But now I'm looking at it and going, at what cost? You know, really? Is it all really about me testing myself as far as I can go? But at the expense of what? And am I actually maintaining a culture that ultimately is just unloving? You know, am I actually keeping an industry going that ultimately is actually hurting other people? I mean, people talk about, you know, maybe I'm not going to buy these sort of sports shoes or clothes because they're made in third world shops, you know, things like that. Honestly, I start to wonder whether or not our ecotourism and all that sort of stuff is actually coming at the expense of a lot of people who shouldn't be suffering.
And all of that thinking and much more coming out of the documentary Sherpa, which gets a massive thumbs up from Mark. It's rated M for mature themes and coarse languages. But Mark says, actually a very watchable film. That's right, a very watchable film, and it's a documentary. Opens this coming Thursday, March 31, at Dendy Cinemas and other selected theatres around the place.
And actually, if you look at the next edition of Eternity, so the April edition coming up, should be in churches now, you'll see my review is on the Eternity website of Sherpa. I rant more there, so please feel free to read that in detail. But then there's another really good thing I want to point you towards in Eternity, and that's My Brokenness is No More or Less Broken Than Yours. It's a story about a fellow called Greg Lake, who until 2013 worked for an Australian immigration department as a director of various immigration detention centres, Christmas Island, Nauru, and things like that. And he now attends a Sydney Baptist church and recently announced on Facebook, for as long as he could remember, he's been attracted to men, not women. Eternity caught up with Greg to find out how a Christian man used to dealing with other people's brokenness deals with his own. It's in the April edition of Eternity in churches now. Well worth your attention.
Mate, still coming up on this program, you are speaking with Joe Lambert, one of the psychologists who works on the 7-year switch, and you're asking her all about the psychology of that new reality program on Channel 7.
Fascinating. You really should stay tuned for this.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. If you've been with us for the whole show, and we know you have been because you love spending time with us, you'll
who
know.
Wouldn't?
You know, earlier we reviewed the 7 Network's new reality TV relationship show, The 7-Year Switch. The more controversial that reality TV programs are becoming, the more the producers of those shows are seeing the need to include psychologists in their crews. These mental health professionals are charged with the task of taking care of contestants who are putting themselves in harm's way for our entertainment. This week, for our press record segment, Mark spoke with Joe Lamble, a clinical psychologist who appears on, and he asked her how she managed to help contestants stay sane in some pretty insane situations.
Joe Lamble, thank you very much for being part of the show. Now, you're a clinical psychologist. Can I begin by asking, did you ever think you were going to be a television presenter when you started your studies?
Oh, gosh, no. That was just a complete accident. Yes, I wrote some books, and you go on a publicity tour when you do that, and they just said, can you come back? And back and back and back. So, yeah, just fell into it.
Well, let's begin by talking about what you're doing with 7 now. Now, you're on the 7-year switch. What's your role on that particular series?
I'm one of two psychologists who are on there. Basically, we're counselling the couples. They've come along with they're very normal. They've got normal relationship issues, and Peter Charleston and I are there to guide them through and try and get their relationships stronger, if that's where it goes, or to make an informed decision about whether to separate.
As far as television is concerned, this is not a normal way of dealing with relationships. Not everybody
everybody does it on national television, but are there some very normal ways they're trying to deal with their relationship within the program itself?
They are. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners would say, gosh, why on earth would people go on national television and air their dirty laundry? But I think they're particularly young. They're all around 30, and they've grown up with this whole idea of being more comfortable with putting themselves out there via social media. So they saw these four genuine couples as, okay, here's an opportunity for us to take a drastic measure to try and save our relationships, which really mean a lot to them. And over 500 couples applied to be part of this. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
Let's talk a bit about why psychologists are becoming involved. Now, there are more and more TV shows that actually have psychologists involved. Maybe some are on camera, but many are behind the scenes. I can think of Kids MasterChef and things like that, where they often have psychologists prepping kids beforehand or afterwards, or contestants on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Again, the same sort of thing with psychologists involved. Why? Why are psychologists becoming involved in TV?
Oh, they have actually been involved for quite a number of years, since reality television. I think that's a duty of care by the networks, that people who are putting their lives so much on public view need a lot of support, and particularly when they're competition elements to the show, then they've got to deal with their expectations, their disappointments, their sense of failure, the conflicts that go on. So you'll find that all those shows, from The Voice, Australia's Got Talent, the MasterChefs, the My Kitchen Rules, all of them, they all have psychologists behind the scenes to help the contestants cope with what is a very stressful environment, which is reality television.
A number of the programs that you named were very contestant-related in terms of, you know, competition and rising to the top. Why would such confident people feel so vulnerable?
Well, as you'd probably know, a lot of people who appear very confident on the surface, you know, are probably just as lacking in confidence as the rest of us. And they can go on with a strong belief of, yeah, I can cook, or I can build, or I can dance, or, you know, whatever it is, I can model. And then, and perhaps they're particularly that. Sounds like I'm being harsh on the younger generation, but they have grown up in this era where parents and schools and clubs are very much encouraging them. You can do anything and you're marvellous, and, you know, participation awards and everything. So they have a very, you know, much stronger belief in themselves. So therefore the fall can often be a lot harder, because when they come up against other people who are just as hungry for success and to win the competition or to go on to greater things in their mind, they can falter, and it can be really, really worrying for them.
Jo, have you found that in your professional capacity, that people of a younger generation today seem to have a higher expectation that they will succeed, that somehow things will go their way?
I have certainly found that, and I find that they have these really, and this is not everyone, but a far greater than in older generations, this sense that they have to really shine at something. Average is not okay. So if they're struggling to find what their thing is that's going to bring them great success, they really feel inadequate. So it's very worrying to me, because average for a reason. that means, you know, it's a massive part of the bell curve. Is most of us who are right there just doing normal things, nothing spectacular. So that's not failure. But the sense of perfectionism and the really high expectations are leading to incredible amounts of stress to either achieve it, or it's leading to complete apathy and giving up and doing nothing and saying, right, well, I'll just wait till it hits me, till somebody gives me my break or someone gives me my job, and then I'll fly.
What do you think of the tendency to create programs, and I don't want you to reflect on your employer, but that need psychologists for contestants, ones that are actually creating ultra stressful environments?
Yeah, it's a really good point. My favourite show of all time is Survivor, and I still love it, and I watch every single season. And those people are genuinely, I really think they're there to prove something to themselves. Can they do this? Can they win? Can they outwit, outlast, you know, whatever it is? I don't think most of them are doing that to necessarily get on television or to be famous. They generally want that challenge, and here's the opportunity. And they've watched other people do it, and they want to achieve it.
And that sounds like you're suggesting that's a healthier way to go. The challenge is with yourself, not the challenge necessarily competing with everybody else there.
That's right. Having said that, though, Mark, I still stand by what we were talking about before, is that the expectations are often so, so high that, you know, it is a long way to fall.
Well, right together now with the next Now Showing segment for The Big Picture. What would it take for you to believe in God? 90 Minutes in Heaven is based on the true story about an American pastor who was declared dead at the scene of a horrific car accident, but he came back. Ben checked out this resurrection tale and what it reports to be the key things we should believe in.
My name is Don Piper. 26 years ago, I died. When I woke up, I was in heaven, but God had other plans for me. Every day of my life, I ask the same question. Oh Lord, why'd you let me see heaven and take it away? Through His plan, I discovered my purpose is to tell you. God still answers prayers. God still performs miracles. Heaven is real.
Not to be confused with that other movie, Heaven is for Real, which also was based on a true story. But that was about a young American boy who said he spent some time in heaven. 90 Minutes in Heaven, as that trailer very helpfully summarized the plot, Mark. It is based on a true story of an American pastor, Don Piper. He's played by the actor Hayden Christensen, who's best known for those Star Wars prequels, Love Him or Hate Him. And his wife in the film is played by Kate Bosworth from Superman Returns. And basically, 90 Minutes in Heaven does not do what it says in the title, Mark.
Okay, it doesn't. Right. So, firstly, this isn't to be confused with that other release recently, Miracles from Heaven?
No. We've sort of got like in the opposite direction. So, Miracles from Heaven, which I think is still in cinemas now, Jennifer Garner's in, also based on a true story. But that was more, you know, the miracles coming down from heaven. This one, as it says in the title and as the trailer suggested, is about a guy visiting heaven. I haven't read the book this is based on, but it was a very popular best-selling book.
It's an international bestseller.
No wonder they made it into a film. What I was most confused with, though, and maybe this is what happens in the book, but it takes about 90 minutes of a two-hour film, maybe a little bit longer, to actually get to the bit where Don Piper talks about his experience in heaven.
Well, hang on a second. It's a two-hour film. Why wouldn't we have 90 minutes of it in heaven?
I know. There is not 90 minutes in heaven. Instead, you get 90 minutes of being stuck with Hayden Christensen in a very wooden performance as he is a guy recovering from a car accident that he wasn't meant to recover from. And the film is largely devoted to him being a very sour and depressed individual in hospital, getting a bit bored and frustrated with his situation, not treating his wife Eva very well, kind of forgetting about the kids, and then also not really practicing what he preaches either. He's a pastor, but he's not really going great guns, I don't think, in terms of helping his own recovery, in terms of relying on spiritual resources that he claims to be relying on.
I'm starting to think that you're not a big fan of this film.
No.
Okay, so what about seeing a Christian family on screen dealing with trauma is not good?
Oh, it's great. It's great. And I thought that was a good thing about 90 Minutes in Heaven, which is out now on DVD and Blu-ray. I think a lot of people will go see it. Those that do see it, I think, will be Christian. This is definitely a movie that is aimed at people who already believe in the claims of Jesus and God. Otherwise, you'll be more bored than I was. It was great to see a family, a Christian family, going through a difficult situation. So life's not all a bed of roses, and terrible things do happen, including being in a car accident where you died and then you came back. That's an amazing story, but I was quite amazed at how unamazing it is on screen, largely down to the story having no real momentum of its own. You just get stuck in this situation of wallowing after the accident, even though 90 Minutes in Heaven, the headline, the title, the kind of hook that gets you in, doesn't really show up till way later in the film, and I didn't think had a great bearing on what actually happens on screen in the meantime, as in his experiences in heaven didn't really reshape his life.
So when we get to the heaven part, dare I ask?
Look, I'm not going to spoil it too much. It's a spoiler in the headline. He does actually claim to have been to heaven. When we get there is a bit of a letdown. It's basically just him recounting his experience, and to me, it sounded like anyone who's got any vague concept of what they think heaven's going to be like, that's just what they did. And including and the superimposed and the overexposed, you know, bright lights people you can vaguely see, and there's your grandpa and that kind of thing. The Portrait of Heaven, I didn't find the most disappointing element of the film. I found the whole film unnecessary. And what I found unnecessary about it is what I think the point is, and the point seems to be that Don Piper, this pastor, believes that he came back, he went to heaven and came back and was sent back so he could go and inspire people with his story. That's cool. I can get into that. But what I didn't really get into is that he seems to be suggesting that he's come back to help people believe. Now, I think that's a dangerous position to get into, because as we're told in plenty of places throughout the Bible, like the end of John's gospel that says all these things about Jesus have been written. We could have written more, but there's enough here that you can believe. And Jesus himself said, those who don't see me but believe because they have learned about me and have accepted the Holy Spirit into their heart and come to understand me more, you will believe. So I think 90 Minutes in Heaven is a dangerous film, because it could suggest that we need someone to say, I've been to heaven and come back and I can tell you about it.
We need extra stuff.
And we need extra stuff. And why would I believe this guy? I'm not saying he did or did not. I don't know. But why would God need to send me this guy who I don't know him from a bar of soap to help me believe in God and the existence of Jesus? Why would I not just turn to God and Jesus themselves?
Yeah, blessed are those who believe and have not seen.
Yeah. So 90 Minutes in Heaven left me pretty cold, Mark.
Well, it sounds like this might be a film that you might be blessed with not seeing.
Mm.
90 Minutes from Heaven is out now on DVD and digital formats. It's rated M for mature themes. It stars Hayden Christensen without a lightsaber, Kate Bosworth, and country singer Dwight Yoakam.
Mate, still to come on the show, the top five sequels that we actually really deep down want to see made. Welcome back to The Big Picture, a Christian perspective on all things popular culture. And if you want more Christian perspectivizing on all things pop culture, Mark, you know where you would head to.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to answer it before you even get there, thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Your place.
Or come around to my place and go to thebigpicturewebsite.com, and you can check out all our past shows on podcasts, and there's reviews and video, and there's articles and stuff.
Much of it.
Lots of it. Bigpicturewebsite.com. Do yourself a favor.
Some of the stuff you'll find there is actually The Vault. And before we get to the top five sequels we'd like to see,
woo,
which we'll be talking about a little later, we had another great idea. Yes, as it happens, we had more than one.
Occasionally.
For this week's segment from The Vault, that regular part of the show where we dive into the back catalogue and check out something worthwhile or notable, we thought we'd ask Insights reviewer Toya Gaddis to pick a TV show from the last 10 years. No, wait. It's something more than that.
Oh.
Because we want to...
I should know. I actually did the segment. Yeah, please keep going. Yes.
We want to pick a TV show from the past decade that ended too early, that left Toya wanting much, much more.
I chose Terra Nova. It aired in 2011.
What is Terra Nova? Sorry to cut you off, Toya. What is Terra Nova? I count myself as quite an avid movie and TV watcher. I think I've heard of Terra Nova. I've definitely never seen it. What is that?
It was a science fiction show that depicted Earth on the verge of collapse from pollution and overpopulation in the year 2129.
Right.
So it was a futuristic TV show. And the premise was, in order to save mankind, scientists found this rip in space and time that allowed people to travel one way back to the Cretaceous period, you know, with dinosaurs and everything.
Okay, yeah.
So it was a very original plot. And the show followed this family that was one of the pilgrimages. So not everyone could go back in time. They were like selected based on whether they would help, you know, the future, and they could, you know, turn around things back in the past.
Right, yeah. Because they couldn't go back to the future, could they? Excuse
no,
that pun.
They went back to the past, yes.
Right, to try to fix the future.
Yes. So that was the premise. They went back to the past. They knew what they had done wrong in the future. So they were traveling back in time and were hoping to somehow save everyone in the future.
But it was only one season long.
Yes, I know. So it was one season. It had a lot of potential. It wasn't the best show, but it had an extremely original plot. It was action-packed with, you know, dinosaurs versus humans, science fiction thriller. It was pretty cool. And it had deeper messages too. Humans were given this opportunity to literally build life again and start civilization again. But this time they knew what they had done wrong in the future. So it was kind of asking these questions of the audience, what would you do differently if you knew what you did wrong and you had the chance to change it?
And in the show, without trying to give too much away, did they make different choices in comparison with the past?
That was where I think the show fell a bit short. It had the opportunity to have these really deep and meaningful questions, but instead they kind of focused on really surface issues like rebellion, so people like rising up and fighting against like all the different civilizations that were being created, and then, you know, corporations from the future were kind of like tampering in what was going on in the past, and they kind of skimmed over what could have been really meaningful and asking important questions, and instead kind of tried to go for shock value, which is right. Why I think it only lasted one season.
Now, you said it was out in 2011?
Yes,
so that's right. You reckon is there a chance they'd make a second season?
Netflix has expressed interest. Look, I think it could definitely go for more seasons. It was directed by Steven Spielberg.
What? And only made one season?
I know, exactly right. It was all the filming and everything was done at the Gold Coast in Queensland. So it was an Australian local. And it also had a few fairly well-known actors. It had the guy from Avatar that was like the commander in Avatar that had his face all scratched
up. Oh, yes, yes.
So he was pretty cool in it. So I think if someone did decide to take it back up and extend seasons, it could definitely go the way of, you know, Breaking Bad, Mad Men. It just needs someone to...
But with dinosaurs.
But with dinosaurs, yes, that's right. And, you know, that's awesome. I love dinosaurs. Who doesn't love dinosaurs?
Mark, you love dinosaurs.
Not really. They leave a huge mess in the lounge room.
Oh, Toya's question was, who doesn't love dinosaurs? You're the person who doesn't. Guy.
Well, anyone who has to clean up after them, or as I refer to them, my children, know very much that that's just not as nice as you think.
If you want more reviews from Toya Gaddis and the Insights team, head to insights.uca.org.au. A great stable of Christian reviewers who love to, like we do, talk about movies and TV from a Christian perspective. insights.uca.org.au. Mark, we are at the end of the show, but as we always do, we're finishing off on the top five list. And have we got a cracker in store for everybody?
Let's face it.
Just quietly.
Let's face it. You've all been in that situation where you've watched a film and gone, wow, like, that's fantastic. And then you find out that it was some low-budget production. They're never going to make a sequel, or someone just wasn't around anymore, or they just went on to better things.
Or you have the reaction that we did when we read about My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, which is at... And that's at cinemas now, which inspired this list of top five choices from us of the sequels we actually want to see made, because as Mark's reaction would demonstrate... My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2 wasn't really at the top of the list.
No, not nowhere near it, in fact.
No.
Anti-sequels.
No. Okay. And, you know, there were things like Blues Brothers 2000 and Matrix Revolutions and Legally Blonde 2, which I found a massive disappointment just quietly. I loved Legally Blonde.
Oh, but I love the musical.
But anyway, those are sequels. We're not talking about those. We're not talking about actual sequels. We're talking about sequels that people, if you're listening and you're a producer and you have money, make these sequels.
These are the ones. Guaranteed success. Let's start.
5.
E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Let's face it, 1982, apparently huge success, or not apparently, a massive success, shaped lives, certainly shaped my wife's life, probably explained who she married. But in that case, you know, you've got a fantastic story about Elliot, the young boy who sends E.T. back home again after getting rid of all the nasty sort of scientists who are trying to dissect him. What happens next? Okay, there's a whole alien civilization out there, Hollywood producers. Come on. Personally, I want to see what happens when E.T. got home. Maybe he tells everybody about the indignities and the messy direction and the hands of the uncaring American scientists. Yay! And then maybe he considers, you know, there's a perfectly nice green planet down there. And all these people, these military types, can be outwitted by children on bicycles. So maybe that's ripe for the taking. Yes, I would like to see E.T. the Invasion. Sort of Mars Attacks meets Independence. I'm thinking kids would love it. Well, my boys would love it. I'd love it.
4. Mike, this movie, it's a little bit of a weird choice because it has been remade, but I'm sure it doesn't have a sequel that ever came from it. 1954's Seven Samurai, Japanese samurai film, as it was suggested in the title. It was remade as The Magnificent Seven, and I think that had sequels. But I don't believe The Seven Samurai, the original, ever had a sequel. And it should, because it was already 3 hours long and it was epic and it was awesome. But I was left wanting much, much more. Now, would the bandits, for anyone who doesn't know the story, a bunch of bandits come and maraud this town, this village in feudal Japan. And they, the townspeople, get money together and pull their resources and hire seven samurais to defend them from the bunch of bandits. Now, I don't want to give the end of the film away, but I would like to know what happened the next year. Not even the next year, the next day. or the next week, because you know, like the plan was really great. It worked out the first time, but we've seen so many franchises ever since that have just basically replayed the same thing over and over again, and have actually effectively recognized that the same situations often occur day in, day out. Why not just make another movie about it? I want that to happen in Seven Samurai. Most times, I'm complaining when things are just exactly the same. I just want exactly the same again. I want like eight samurai, and it can go for 4 hours.
Do you think the bandits would have had an idea? Maybe we'll go back again.
But I'm hoping so, and I'm hoping they're going to make that sequel, even though it would be like 60 years after the event.
And that's possibly the best direction to take a sequel, 60 years after what happened next.
Did you know that Bambi, the original, was made in 1942, and Bambi 2 was made in 2006, 63 years after the event. That's the longest gap between any sequel in history. I'm really glad you asked, you raised that point.
But the average lifespan of a deer is 7 years. So how is it that Bambi, so was it Bambi's great-great-great-great-grandson?
I don't know. I didn't see the movie. The point is, it's the longest gap between sequels in sequel history. What's your number three choice?
I should actually say, look, 2004, we saw The Incredibles, okay? The Incredibles, the last scene of the Disney classic. It's a fantastic sort of family film about, you know, a family of superhumans who actually have family problems and how they work it out. And in the last scene, baby Jack-Jack develops superpowers. You know, everyone thought he might not walk or talk, but there he is. He gets superpowers and becomes something of a devilish time bomb in the hands of the crazed villain syndrome. And now we finally see the incredible family as it was meant to be, just as the Underminer, who I'm always under you, breaks through the surface of the city, and that's the end of the film. Come on.
Isn't there an incredible sequel?
There's not an incredible sequel.
Have you gone and checked? Because Pixar are making sequels of everything. Well, like I'm everything sure from Finding Dory to Monsters University. Like, I would have thought they'd be doing that. That was a really successful Pixar movie.
And they're busy. They're basically busy. I'd like to see a bit more of that family. They went through some pretty deep waters together, including trouble between mum and dad, identity issues, unemployment, and they came out stronger than ever. Surely there's a life lesson left. I don't know. Old age? Back problems? It's something.
Cutting off your choice to get back to me so I can talk more about this movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 2004. Why have they not made a sequel to that? Surely you like that movie. Don't be chuckling in the face of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I really like that film, okay? Wasn't it a happy ending?
Let's not give the game away. For anyone who hasn't seen it, Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet are in this really bonkers kind of relationship drama. There's some comedy elements, but it's a really weird look at a relationship that's fallen apart and then what the couple will do afterwards. And they use this newfangled technology in the movie of being able to erase their own memories of each other. So effectively, they don't remember that they had the relationship that they had. So they can sort of sort out their pain and that kind of thing. And as the film goes along, the character Jim Carrey plays doesn't want the procedure done anymore. So a lot of the film is him running around his own head trying to protect his own memories and of the relationship with Kate Winslet. So I want to see the sequel. Like what? So what would you do next? Would they have a sequel where they implanted memories into people's heads of fake relationships? So really lonely people
So this is not like your classic sequel of what happens to these characters, but the idea itself.
The idea itself. So could you just flip it on its head and go in the opposite direction? Now, I think it sounds quite sad, the idea I'm suggesting, but if you want to go in a completely different direction as opposed to Seven Samurai, which I just want to see the same thing again, can people run around inside their own heads implanting memories, but then probably along the way realize, oh no, actually we don't really want that because it's a bit sad and it's not real, really real life. And it's
didn't
not
you
real
just describe Inception?
On our top five list of sequels that we want to see, at number two, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind 2, is actually Inception.
One. Okay, but this one has definitely not been made, right? Okay. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, 1986, right?
Like a
fantastic
choice.
80s film of basically high school kids who just decide to blow the day off at school and do what they actually want to do. I imagine a much older Ferris, you know, not hard considering Matthew Broderick's in his late 60s now anyway, but who's failed to keep up with his freewheeling philosophy, and his friends find him for one last big day out. Sort of the bucket list meets the best exotic marigold hotel.
Why did you have to sell it like that? I was really into that idea until you got there.
Yeah, well, much better than that. I'll write
So he's day out of the home his last day before retirement.
Yeah, something like that. I'm imagining, though, that Ferris has a new life lesson to share with us? You know, something like that, that fun is fun, but it doesn't really work as a reason for living. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's got the perspective of old age. And I'm hoping for something profound, you know? Something fun, just like that original Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I'd like to title Ferris Bueller's Last Day Off. Okay, or something like that, or next day off, because you could then have
then
a
you can have another. I know, don't get last. You're painting yourself into a corner.
I know, what am I doing? But all, so long as we've got to do it quick, okay, because Principal Rooney in this structure, if Ferris Bueller was a teenager, he's going to be in his late 90s, and I'm not sure how many buses of snotty kids we can get him stuck on in time, or how many times, how funny it is kicking old men. So frankly, you know, we've got to hurry this one along.
Ferris?
He doesn't have a fever, but he says his stomach hurts and he's seeing spots.
What's the matter, Ferris?
Papa?
Honey, feel his hands. They're cold and clammy.
Dude.
I'm fine. I get up.
No.
No!
No. I have a test today.
No!
I have to take it. I want to go to a good college so I can have a fruitful life.
Honey, you're not going to school like this now.
Oh, fine. What's this? What's his problem?
He doesn't feel well.
Yeah, right. Dry that one out. You can fertilize the lawn.
Top five list of sequels that we really want to see made, Mark, is basically just an excuse for us to talk about movies that we really, really like and encourage everybody to go and check out. So you should go and check out E.T., Seven Samurai, The Incredibles, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And
you
Ferris,
are welcome.
And Ferris Bueller's next day off when I finally make it.
That's right. That's been the show for this week. Great show, if I don't mind saying so ourselves.
Well, coming back next week, please. Disney has brought back Rudyard Kipling's The Jungle Book again, but this time with real animals.
Where to invade next? Question mark. According to documentarian Michael Moore, anywhere but America.
And you've seen Divergent, Insurgent, and now we bring you Detergent. Actually, I think that one's Allegiant.
What you did there. Oh, I'll still be chuckling next week as Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley. See ya.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.